This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Coming up in just a moment here on the Afternoon Magazine, we're going to talk about forgiveness with Dr. Jeannie Safer, author of Forgiving and Not Forgiving, A New Approach to Resolving Intimate Betrayal. Dr. Safer will join us this afternoon from Chicago, and we're getting everything ready and in place in the studio in Chicago. So just bear with us for another and we'll be right here with a conversation with Jeannie Safer. Stay tuned. Central Illinois zoos are home to hundreds of wild animals from throughout the world and offer educational and entertaining recreation for the entire family. In September, WILL invites member benefit cardholders to visit the Miller Park Zoo in Bloomington, Wildlife Prairie Park in Peoria, and Scoville Zoo in Decatur at free or discounted admission prices. Call us at 217-333-0850 for specific discounts and telephone numbers. Then visit with your member benefit card. To find out how you can get a WILL member benefit card, call 800-898-1065. That's 800-898-1065. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Hillary Clinton says she has forgiven her husband for his affairs. Is her forgiveness genuine? Psychotherapist Jeannie Safer says it is not. And Safer says compromising our relationship with the truth is hurting our public and private lives. Today on the Afternoon Magazine, the nature of forgiveness. What is forgiveness? Are some things unforgivable? Dr. Jeannie Safer is our guest. She's been a practicing psychotherapist for 25 years. She has written articles for many publications, including The Wall Street Journal and The New York Times. She's the author of two books. The latest is Forgiving and Not Forgiving, A New Approach to Resolving Intimate Betrayal. The book, as its title indicates, is as much about not forgiving as forgiving. Listeners, join us with your questions and comments. I look forward to your phone calls. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else in Illinois or Indiana, toll free, 1-800-222-9455. 1-800-222-WILL. Dr. Safer, good afternoon and welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
I'm glad to hear you. Why do you think Hillary Clinton's public statement of forgiveness is not authentic?
Real forgiveness is a very complicated, long process. And there's some telltale signs in the interviews that she's given to Talk Magazine most recently that what she says, and I'm sure she is sincere about this, but what she says does not indicate that she's gone through the punishing process that real forgiveness involves. And there are a number of reasons in her statements that can suggest that. First of all, she says that Bill's sin is one of weakness, not malice, thereby denying the hostility. She says she stayed with him out of selfless love, which may be partially true, but not entirely true. She blames the vast right-wing conspiracy and the news media for the problem, not for him. And then on top of it, she then says that she explains it away by saying that his childhood experiences with his mother and grandmother caused him to become an adulterer. And all of these are examples of a person who says the right words, who talks the talk, but does not really walk the walk of true forgiveness, because true forgiveness involves recognizing hostility, recognizing rage and hurt, and holding nobody but the perpetrator accountable. No news media, no parents, no nobody. Even though you can say that these things were part of what caused the problem, only Bill is responsible. And I don't feel that her public statements indicate that she really sees that, and therefore she has not deeply forgiven him.
Yeah. It's very interesting to think about forgiveness and hostility at the same time.
Yes. They're always involved together, by the way.
Yeah.
I think we overlook that.
It's a tough thing to begin to think about, because we don't generally think about hostility as being a component of forgiveness. How does that work?
Well, first of all, there's hostility in an act of betrayal. An act of betrayal is always, and a betrayal is different from something that a stranger does to you, because it's somebody that you love, somebody that you trust, and somebody who you feel considers you. And in the act of betrayal, the person who betrays you shows, at least for that moment, that they don't consider you, that you and your feelings don't matter, only they matter. So that is essentially an act of hostility. It may not be intended against you, but the point is that they didn't care about you enough to not do it. And then in our reactions to the action of betrayal, everybody universally feels hatred. Feels the wish for vengeance. That's normal at first. Now, if it goes on for the next 25 years, of course, that's another matter. But at first, so there is a great deal of hostility involved in this process. And even later, you know, we think of forgiveness, in my opinion, as much too selfless a behavior, that we give selfless love to the other. Well, I think that in most actions of forgiveness, we have to work through hostility in order to come to any kind of feeling of love. And we may still feel ambivalent even if we've forgiven. For instance, when we forgive the dead, one of the reasons that I think it sometimes is easier to forgive somebody who's dead is that they've been punished. You know, they're dead, we're alive, and they've stopped hurting us. And I think there's a certain, what I would call, healthy hostility involved. Now, we're not talking about going out and trying to harm somebody. We're talking about feelings of anger that I think in America we're too uncomfortable. We have to have all of our good totally good, and we never feel that people can be ambivalent. And I think ambivalence is normal.
Yeah. Now, in your opinion piece for the New York Post on the Clinton situation, you wrote that this form of forgiving, this form of exonerating transgression, is currently sweeping the country and compromising our relationship with the truth in our public and private lives. Would you explain?
I feel very passionate about this, that people immediately asked to be forgiven. As soon as something happens, they stand up and say, "If I have hurt anyone," you know, this is a guaranteed sign that it's not real. A real forgiveness action, a real act of contrition, is saying, "I did hurt. I caused terrible damage, and I am facing that, and I am trying to change that, and I want to be held accountable, and I want to make restitution." If you don't say that, forget it. But anyway, there are these actions of public demonstrations of contrition. action. And there are also actions, which I'm also disturbed about. By any time anything terrible happens, somebody always stands up and gives a press conference. One of the victims of Littleton, actually, I was disturbed to see, young girl, from her hospital bed. She said, "The first thing I want to say is that I forgive the man who tried to kill me because I want to get on with my life." Now, to me, this is a good example of someone who has not gone through a process of forgiveness. And how could she? She was just almost killed. Forgiveness takes time. It's a process. And if we don't go through it, if we just make public announcements and give lip service, we really alienate ourselves from the feelings that we have about a betrayal that we must only get over by working through. You only get past pain by going through it. You can't just make an announcement and put it aside. It's not real. And whether it's public or private, when it isn't real, it doesn't change. There's no psychic transformation that takes place unless you go through the process and acknowledge everything that happened in all of its devastation.
Mm. Has our thinking about forgiveness changed over time? Are we, in recent years, have we been involved in a rush to move on, to forgive?
Yes, I think so. It's a very disturbing thing. I think we have on our hands a kind of epidemic of pseudo-forgiveness. It's interesting because all of our movies are about vengeance. I think, in a way, maybe we like vengeance because we're forced so much, there's so many lobbyists to forgive. I think this is probably an outgrowth, an unintentional outgrowth of the 12-step movement. It's a kind of outgrowth of a popularization of a particular Christian position, which, by the way, not all Christians believe in, but it certainly is Christian dogma. And we have this notion that without forgiveness, we can't be mentally healthy. We'll be depressed. We'll have corrosive hatred. You know, isn't it interesting that we have no word for normal unforgiveness? There's no word. I had to make it up, and it sounds so awkward, normal unforgiveness. We can't even conceive of anything but forgiveness as a good thing to do.
Yeah. In the latest Newsweek, the one with Susan Faludi on the cover, there's a piece in there. It's called My Turn. It's a regular feature. And there's a woman who writes about being very disturbed at seeing something go on a playground. A bully attacks her son, and eventually he gives her the sign like, yeah, you can say something to him, because it went on. And so she went up to this kid and she said, "Knock it off. I'm very angry, and don't ever do that again to my son, my boy." And she writes in there about feeling conflicted before she actually got up and went
and took a stand like that.
Took a stand, and she said, "You know, we're so used to being told to go over to that little tyke and say, 'Are you having a bad day?'"
Right, and particularly women are told to do this. You know, in her role as a mother, she was probably doubly devastated. We have to hold people accountable, even if they're children, even if there are children, before we forgive. And that's what we miss. You know, it may be that that kid had a bad day. It may be that he had been beaten himself. But that does not excuse what he did. And before you can ever go beyond something, you must first face what's going on. And I feel that we're not doing this enough in America. It's very disturbing to me.
Yeah. There comes a time to get mad.
Yes. And that doesn't mean that you have to get even. But, you know, what I also want to say is that it's normal to want to get even. It's abnormal to seek to get even over, you know, after a betrayal for years afterwards. But to feel that you shouldn't even want to get even at first, well, why not? You know, you've been hurt. Your natural instinct is to try to undo your helplessness. Mm. And that's what we should feel. It's only later that we can work things through. And we need to take more time in this country to work things through and to think about things. I'm very disturbed that we have the MTV mentality and that everything has to happen instantly, including forgiveness. You know, in the book, I talk about my own experience forgiving my father. It took me 20 years. And I'm a psychoanalyst. I do this all day long for a living, and it took me 20 years to do it. So, of course it takes time, and we need to take the time.
Yeah. But now let's go back to what we learned growing up in church.
The golden rule.
In church, right, in church and synagogue.
Yes.
To err is human, to forgive divine. Many of us have been taught that we should strive. We should really work at turning
the other cheek.
What do we do with these ideals, these goals? Do we abandon them? How do we make sense of all the emotion and the hostility and our wish to come to a resolution.
And our wish to be
things.
Good and ethical people.
Right.
Well, this is a terrible dilemma. It's not something that has a simple answer. And I think for some truly religious people, probably seeking to forgive is a good thing. But my feeling is that forgiveness, if it's going to come, the best kind is natural. When you work through a betrayal and you resolve it and you understand it, and it's a three-step process. I interviewed 50 people, and it seems to me that there's a specific kind of process one goes through. If you go through that, if forgiveness is in the cards, it will happen. And if it doesn't, healthy resolution will happen. But remember, you know, vengeance is mine, said the Lord. And the reason he said it is because we want to make it ours. that's why. But within Christianity and Judaism, there are actually slightly different views of forgiveness. And during this time, right around the high holidays, we're coming up on Yom Kippur, the Jewish view of forgiveness is somewhat different from the Christian. For the Jew, if the person who perpetrated the crime against you is not contrite, you are under no obligation to forgive, according to the rabbi that I spoke to. This is not true within Christianity, by the way. It doesn't matter if the person is contrite or not. You must forgive. Judaism is a bit more ambivalent and a bit more open-ended about this. But for Christians, you always have to love the sinner and hate the sin. And that's tough to do.
Yeah.
So I think it's a terrible dilemma. I wish I could say that it's a simple thing to get out of. But what I heard from many Christians is that they have a much more forgiving notion of forgiveness than the church expects, so that they don't feel always that they have to not be angry anymore. As long as you don't feel hatred, anger really is kosher to mix religious metaphors. And I think if people realize this, that anger, a little anger never killed anybody. You know, ambivalence towards someone you forgive is normal. We don't have to be perfect. We're not angels. You know, if we can just work it through, if we can just not feel enraged or the desire to be vengeful anymore, this is enough. You know? And if it goes further, give it time. It's like love. You can't create forgiveness. You can make yourself receptive, but you cannot create it, and you don't need to feel that you have to create it. You don't need to feel guilty if you can't forgive. And what also concerns me is that there's so many pressures on people from their families, from the society, to be forgiving. And this, I think, leads to what I was saying before, this epidemic of false or light forgiveness, automatic forgiveness, because when you feel you've got to do it in order to be good, how can you not do it? So you do it on the outside and not on the inside.
L-I-T-E, forgiveness.
Yes.
very interesting insight in your book about forgiveness and remembering. Remembering is the essence of forgiving, someone
yes.
told you.
Very different from forgiving and forgetting, which
right.
is what we all think. Remembering is the essence of being yourself. And if I don't remember what happened to me and the hurts I suffered and the hurts I caused, how am I myself? I mean, they may not be loom so large. You know, over the 20 years that I have forgiven my own father and I've hopefully grown more mature in that time, it doesn't have the same role in my life as it did then, but I haven't forgotten it. And I don't want to forget my past.
Mm.
You know, psychotherapy, serious psychotherapy, is about coming to terms with the past, maybe changing your relationship with the past, but not never forgetting the past. You know, Faulkner said, the past isn't dead, it isn't even past. And I subscribe to that notion.
Yeah. Let's go back to forgiveness as a three-step process. Talk with us about those steps and what happens
yes.
in those steps. Re-engaging. Recognizing the emotional impact of what has happened, and then putting it all back together again.
Or letting it put itself back together again.
Right.
Some of this happens without, if you put yourself in the situation, it sometimes takes care of itself. Well, re-engagement is the willingness. Now, this is a conscious thing you do. It's a willingness to go back to the trauma, to say, I'm going to reconsider what happened, and I'm going to reconnect with the experience that I had with that person, you know, which means I'm not going to deny it anymore. I'm not going to just hate the person. I'm going to go back and look at it. That's sometimes the hardest, I think, it was for me. And then the second step is recognition, and that's the other hardest. In fact, they're all hardest. Recognition is really feeling and seeing exactly what happened in all its gory detail. Somebody said to me, you mean I have to go through all the details? And I said, yes, every rotten one of them, because otherwise you won't know what really happened to you. And you're kind of blunted when you go through a trauma. So in the aftermath of it, sometimes you can go back and you can really recognize everything that happened. And then the third step, if you go through those two, is reinterpretation. And what this is seeing it in three dimensions, seeing it from a broader perspective, including understanding the motivation of the person who harmed you in a different way. And by the way, you don't go through these steps necessarily one after the other. You can mix them all up. You can do them over again. You forgive yourself. You forgive the other. You unforgive yourself. You unforgive the other. And this can go on for quite a long time. And that's quite natural, too. There's no one-size-fits-all way to do this. But when you go through it, whether you end up forgiving or whether you end up not forgiving, you come out different and you come out wiser. That's really the whole point of this. It's about the process, not the outcome.
Let's talk with a caller. We have a caller waiting for us on line 4 in Eureka. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I'd like to ask two questions, if
yes.
possible. First, and I realize this may not be something for public consumption, is what action did you have to forgive your father for?
Well, it's for public consumption because I wrote a book about it. When I was 16, I came home one night. My mother was out of town, and I found my father in a very compromising position with two young women. It was quite a devastation to me. And then later, after that, I really separated myself from him, and I was not around when he was dying. And because my father was also a wonderful man as well as a liar and many other things, many years later, I had to grieve for that.
I see. My second question would be, you appeared to me, as I understood you, critical of 12-step programs, I guess.
Well, critical of this aspect. I think they're great for people who are going through 12-step programs. Yeah. I just don't think it applies necessarily to the entire world.
Yeah, I understood you say that they were maybe fostering a kind of speeded-up process of forgiveness and not dealing with a lot of the emotional aspects.
Well, yes. They also say that if you don't forgive, this is one of the reasons that you drink. One of the 12 steps is to forgive. There's a real push, because it comes out of the Christian theology, there's a real push to forgive within these programs rather than to just work it through and resolve, which would probably may often come to forgiveness.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other calls are welcome if you're in the Champaign-Urbana area. Our number, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Excuse me. Our guest this afternoon is Dr. Jeannie Safer. We're talking about forgiveness. She is the author of Forgiving and Not Forgiving, A New Approach to Resolving Intimate Betrayal. If we've been betrayed,
everybody has.
Right.
Little ways, big ways.
Okay. We don't have a responsibility to forgive. However, do we have a responsibility to consider forgiveness?
I think we have a responsibility to ourselves to understand our own lives. I don't like to set agendas for people. I don't like to set agendas for patients. I didn't set out to forgive my father. I set out to understand my own life. And I think if one does this with seriousness and with realism, forgiveness very often happens. If there was enough love to be recovered, and if there isn't, it won't happen. So I do not believe that we have a responsibility to consider forgiveness. I think we have a responsibility to see the truth, wherever that leads us. Although that's a scary thing. Because sometimes it puts us in opposition with current trends, because there's so much pressure on people to be forgiving. It's unbelievable.
Let's take a couple of other calls. Our next caller is on line 1 in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I wonder if you would talk a little bit about forgiveness and non-forgiveness of self.
Oh, yes. Thanks for bringing that up. It's my favorite topic. I have a chapter, actually, on self-forgiveness, because I feel that self-forgiveness is the only kind of forgiveness that's probably essential, because it's the basis, it's the foundation of forgiving anyone else. And what self-forgiveness is really facing, it's the same three-step process. It's really facing what you've done, who you've hurt, including yourself, the terrible consequences of it, how awful you feel about it, and trying to see it in three dimensions. And when you do that, you can very often have a different relationship to yourself. And the reason that I think that self-forgiveness is so essential is that you can't get away from yourself. You know, you could sever your relationship with any other human being on this planet except the one you see in the mirror every day. That one you're stuck with.
Let's talk.
Does that answer your question?
The caller has already left us.
Oh.
So, but let's go on and take another call on line two, a caller in Champaign. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, I was just calling regarding the 12-step question.
Yes.
As a member of a 12-step program, the oldest one, I feel that it's important to point out something that in our program we stress the importance of forgiving others and not harboring resentments as a means of staying sober and staying alive. So it's really a question of survival. But I don't think it's something that we take lightly or...
Oh, no, I was never suggesting that. I'm just saying that to not harbor resentments, you don't necessarily have to forgive. One cannot harbor resentments and have a detached experience of another person. I think that forgiveness and vengeance are given as the dichotomy, and it's a false dichotomy.
Oh, okay. Well, I don't have any problem with that one. I look forward to reading your book.
Oh, good.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. That leads me to ask this question of you, which you actually ask in the book. If forgiveness is not the goal, what does a good enough resolution consist of?
A good enough resolution is facing the truth of your own life and doing the work of looking at it, of cultivating receptivity to always be open to looking at more, to examining yourself and your surroundings with as much honesty as you can muster. That's what I think.
Mm. Can one come to reconciliation without forgiving?
Now, the definition of reconciliation is reestablishing a relationship with a person who has hurt you. Mm-hmm. Now, this, in my opinion, this can be as it was for me, even if the person is no longer alive. So I think, in a way, it really depends on being able to forgive. Although, one of the things that was very interesting with the people that I talked to is that there are all kinds of nuances and subtleties and places on this spectrum. So some people were able to reestablish relationships without even totally forgiving. I called them partial unforgivers. So, in a way, one can do a little bit of it, as long as you recognize that it's legitimate that the relationship has changed and will never be the same.
Yeah. And you call this an ethical form of retribution.
Yes. Yes. See, these are concepts that don't have much place in the modern world. We humans are ambivalent. That's one of the things that Freud taught us. We're full of love and hate. And we have to look at our angry sides and our hostile sides and so that they don't rule us. And one of the biggest ways to be ruled by hatred is to deny it. It's to say, you know, I just forgive you. I just love you. You're just wonderful. And that makes me, I'm so self-righteous. You know? I'm just a saint and you're a sinner. I hate people like that.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's going to
come. And I do it unambivalently.
Yeah, it's going to come back and bite you.
Oh, yes.
Big time.
It comes out underneath. If you don't face hostility, it always finds a way out. And that's why I believe we should look at it. That's what this book is about.
Yeah. Let's talk with another caller on line one in Champaign. Hi.
Hi. I mean, you've kind of gotten at this already, but I guess I'd like to, you know, come out a little more specifically.
Sure.
And that I know a lot of people who... blame themselves for things that were done to them when they were children, and
yes.
But you know they turn it around and continue to you know find you know or blame themselves and have self
hatred.
Yeah,
it's a very typical reaction when you're a child to blame yourself for what happened. So that, again, if you follow those three steps, part of the re-engagement is looking at it again, and that includes making yourself look at the other person's side. You know, some of us have to look at our own side. It's harder for us to see what we did, but some people have a hard trouble looking at what the other person did. And I've got a lot of cases in the books of people who felt like, in fact, their parents made them feel that if somebody in the family hurt them, that it had to be their fault because they should be the bigger person. They were better. The brother was damaged. That's why he set you on fire. So I think self-blame is something that we have to work through.
What about if, you know, these things happen when a person was young enough that they don't really have a clear memory, you know, and then those people then are gone out of their lives, and it's very difficult for them to reconstruct, you
it
know?
It is difficult, but we do the best that we can with the knowledge that we have in the present. And, you know, many of the things that happen to us when we're younger, we still have on some level within us. They're in our dreams. You'd be surprised how much you can get back if you think about it.
Mm-hmm.
I hope that helps you.
All right, thanks.
Thanks.
Thanks for the call. Would you offer us an example of someone who found resolution without forgiveness and how they worked, how they got to where
they worked that through?
Yeah.
Yes, I have a dear friend who is a therapist who had a truly awful mother. She's in the book. You know, mother love is supposed to be the greatest love of all, but this woman, this was not, as Jackie Mason says, this was not her field. She was not cut out to be a mother. She really was, more than brutal, she was cold. And she just could never love her daughter. And her daughter is a very, very lovable person, I can attest. And when her mother died, my friend felt like a monster because she did not grieve for her mother. In fact, she was glad she was dead. She never told anybody this. But she hated herself because she felt, how can I be a loving person if I don't love my own mother? And, of course, she also must have felt, I must be a rotten kid if she never loved me. And then what happened to her, later in her life, a dear friend of hers died of breast cancer, and she was grief-stricken and devastated. And she had the very good luck to be with an excellent therapist who said to her, it's okay if you can love and grieve for your friend and not your mother. Your friend loved you and your mother didn't. She said that was the greatest day of her life.
Hmm. What do your colleagues think of this book?
Mixed reactions. There's a movement within psychology. It's the Universal Forgiveness Movement. They have a journal. They haven't forgiven me. There are $10 million worth of grants on fostering forgiveness that are being given out by the Templeton Foundation, and alas, not one on fostering healthy unforgiveness, except me. But many of my colleagues, particularly the psychoanalysts, feel that it's quite compatible with them because, you know, our whole position is to help people become themselves and to face the past and not setting specific agendas for them. The forgiveness people have a whole 17-step program for forgiving, and they say this can rarely be accomplished in one session. This is true. Tried 20 years in some cases.
You have three types of healthy unforgivers. Walk with us through those three types.
Well, there are moral unforgivers who feel that it is a moral stance to refuse to condone evil, and that it would be evil to condone what happened to them, and that it would invalidate their lives. These are often cases of incest or some kind of physical abuse where the person refuses to believe that it happened, and where the families very often are lobbying. I also have psychologically detached unforgivers who simply, too much happened. This is a case of the friend I just mentioned, whose mother just never loved her, and she felt it was a great accomplishment to no longer hate her mother. But she couldn't love her. She never did. Or if she did, it was lost. And I also have religiously conflicted, reformed unforgivers, people who used to forgive because they said that they had to, or they thought they had to, and they came to a recognition that they no longer needed to, and were freed by that, and felt that they could still have their religious faith and not forgive.
Hmm. Dr. Jeannie Safer is our guest this afternoon on the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking with her about forgiveness. She's the author of Forgiving and Not Forgiving, A New Approach to Resolving Intimate Betrayal. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. We have another caller waiting to talk with us on line one, a caller in Champaign.
Ma'am? Hi.
Yes?
I would like to compliment your guest in that I believe that laughter is the best medicine, and also concerning mothers being kind of cold or emotionally closed, maybe that's for a reason, because maybe those mothers were hurt really bad.
Maybe they were, but that's still, they have to be held accountable to how cruel they are to their children. We can explain things without excusing people on the basis of them.
And I guess
I guess he didn't agree with that.
I guess not. That's okay. Right?
I forgive him.
Okay. For your book, you interviewed more than 50 people. Can you give us an idea of the people you interviewed? Who were they? What ages?
Oh, they came from all walks of life. Well, my favorite set of examples are a princess, a prostitute, my next door neighbor. Not the same person.
That'd be
murderer.
A lot rolled into one.
Yes, I interviewed a murderer who was able to forgive himself. Fascinating story. The people I interviewed were from about age, my youngest was 19, my oldest was 85. It really is an experience that one has throughout one's life. I have a chapter actually on the differences of struggling with forgiveness at different times in your life. Some people can do it when they're young, some people in middle age, and some when they're old, and it's a different kind of experience at different times. It was extraordinary to talk to these people. Some of the people that I interviewed were close personal friends, and I learned very intimate things about them. You know, we don't talk about these things with each other. I saw two of my closest friends weep for the first time in 20 years of friendship. And marvel, there were also some wonderful stories of reconciliation. I don't want to give the impression that I'm against forgiveness or I don't believe it ever should happen. One extremely touching story of a dear friend of mine whose father had disinherited him for reasons he could never figure out and gave his brother, made him a multimillionaire before the age of 40. My friend never even knew about this. And then the brother died of a brain tumor. And wonder of wonders, the father changed. The father realized that he'd been a fool, that he had a son left who was a good man, and he asked his son's forgiveness. And then when the father was dying, the son was his devoted, loving son. And they only had a few years together that way, but it really made the difference. And when I was at the funeral, I said to my friend, "Your father is a remarkable man. He changed in his 80s, and this is a remarkable legacy to you." So that was a pretty wonderful story.
Yeah. What about the murderer? How did he come to forgive himself?
He was an intriguing guy. He was a member of the Westies gang in New York City. This is the gang. This is the Irish mafia. The Italian mafia hires out their crimes that are too violent to the Westies to do. So they're the enforcers for the mafia. And this is a guy. He was about 300 pounds and 6'6". This huge behemoth. And everybody left him alone in the prison. He was there for a conspiracy, and I saw him afterwards when he'd been out for a few years. And he used to walk there. Nobody bothered him. You can see why. And one day, this older man in his late 60s was falling, and this little scrawny guy, turned out this guy was a five-time murderer, was in for five consecutive life sentences. And he used to follow this guy around, and he said to him one day, he said, "Who put you here? Who put you here?" And my murderer said, "Ah, the cops did." And he explained the story. He was set up and this and that. And he said, no, "Who put you here?" And he kept at this for a few weeks. And one day, his interlocutor took a mirror out of his pocket, held it up to my murderer and said, "This is who put you here, and this is the guy you've got to forgive." And looking in that mirror really changed his life. This five-time murderer had become a counselor in prison. He devoted his remaining years to trying to convert prisoners, to make them see the light. And this time he succeeded. Mm. Isn't that an amazing story?
Yeah.
It was very moving to hear. Because what struck me about it is that looking in the mirror is exactly what I did myself. I didn't murder anybody physically to do it, but we went through the same process, really.
Yeah.
It was fascinating.
In a situation involving a parent...
Mm. Very hard.
Yeah, and let's say the parent dies before,
yes,
you know, before there's resolution.
Yes,
and siblings come together and talk about the parent.
Mm-hmm.
And
a very common scenario.
Yeah, and you know, their experiences are just real different.
I hear a personal note in this.
It's completely hypothetical.
Yes, it's, you know, it's really interesting. I have a chapter called The Eye of the Beholder because this is so subjective. One of the reasons that I feel that we can't make an agenda for people to forgive is that people define betrayal and what needs forgiveness very differently. And what one sibling experiences as a betrayal, another just doesn't notice the same way. It's fascinating. Mm. So, you know, we have to stick by our own experience, even if our sibling thinks something totally different.
Yeah.
It's very important.
So there is a resolution that has to happen there.
Well, let's hope we can resolve. Yeah. You know, also, not everything can be resolved. We can work towards it, but we shouldn't feel guilty if we continue to have ambivalence, if we continue to have conflict. All we can do is our best. We can be what I call good enough at forgiving. That's all we can do, and that's enough.
Mm. We've got some other callers waiting to talk with us. Let's go next to line four, Champaign County. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes, I have not heard the whole show, but I'm calling because I wanted to ask, what do you do if those that have perpetrated abuse, they want to continually put it on to you that it was it's in the past and
right.
that you're not forgiving them, when it's not a matter of forgiveness, it's the fact that some of the same behaviors that led
continuing.
Up to it in the past are still continuing.
Yes. I'm very frequently asked this question, and it's a real doozy. It's one person described it as a quagmire, and it is. And what you have to do is stand your ground. You have to say, as long as this behavior continues and you're not taking responsibility, I refuse to continue to have a relationship with you, or only a very distant one. You must take your ground.
Is it pretty common for people to blame the person that they have wronged, that you're
absolutely
they're not forgiving, and what kind of a response
can you
give them without feeling put down that you're the one who's in the wrong? That's usually what happens.
Yes,
I feel
it's
wrong.
Very easy for that to happen, and you simply have to feel that you have a right to your own feelings, and you can say, I have looked at this, I have thought about this, and you are not taking responsibility for what you did. It's not up to me. This is not the idea of turning the other cheek that I hope that Christian theologians had in mind.
Yeah.
We don't have to get our faces slapped that much.
Right. We're going to take one more call, and we're going to have to really try and keep it brief. Our next caller is on line one in Urbana. Hi.
Hi. Well, let's see. I think this is a great program.
Thank you.
I think the doctor is marvelous. It's wonderful to keep a sense of humor through this world. And it really helps.
Particularly when you're trying to forgive. Believe me, you need all the help you can get.
Right. And I think you've said some things that are so important. For instance, you just said you have a right to your own feelings. You don't have to have the feelings someone else thinks you should
Absolutely.
Have.
Absolutely. There is no one-size-fits-all. Remember that. It'll help you in life.
Well, I just think you are one of the more sensible, level-headed, good people who have entered your field.
Well, thank you so much. I will take that back with me.
There are people in your field who aren't that way.
I've noticed.
Yeah. One of the things that has really bothered me, and I feel sorry for all the people. Oh, that's another thing. I say those words.
We got to wrap it up.
Okay. Anyway, thank you for a great program. I'm going to look up your book.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Nice call
that was terrific.
To wrap up with. Thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
Dr. Jeannie Safer has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. The title of her book, Forgiving and Not Forgiving, A New Approach to Resolving Intimate Betrayal. The book is published by Avon.